Welcome to the Mike to New Haven podcast with sports personality Mike Colon. Here's your host, Mike Colon.
Yeah, the Steinberg case was a case involving a lawyer that lived in Manhattan, like on 10th Street, who got an illegal adoption of two children. And his wife was Hedda Nussbaum. She was a writer at the time before when he met her. And she was an abused woman, and the kids were also abused. Lisa Steinberg died from head injuries, you know, that she sustained from Joel Steinberg, who was her illegally adopted father, who was a lawyer, a cokehead, you know, a piece of crap, because I mean, he wound up hurting her to the point that she had a brain hemorrhage and she wound up dying. That was a really big case in New York at the time. And the reason why was back then, when I was a cop in the early 80s, like any domestic incident involving a family, like nothing happened. Like, you know, the guy would just get thrown out of the house, but he'd be able to come back. You know, there was really no rules about men beating up women. You know, there was really no way of reporting child abuse cases, you know, and Lisa Steinberg's case kind of like opened the door to ACS having what they call a prompt response. You know, ACS is child welfare, administrative for children's services. It was the child welfare unit back then. So it opened up a lot of doors on reporting child abuse cases. There was mandatory reporters then set up, like schools have a mandatory reporters, doctors are mandatory reporters, you know, and also then things change with women.
Even then, I had my eye on, I wanted to make sure I was doing my job well, but I also was working toward the next. And so when I was working as a booker for radio, where I was courting interviews for our affiliate radio stations, I would do that during my normal, you know, allotted time. But then in my free time, I would do the job I wanted to do, which is write, as I said. So I would shadow our producer who was producing the 1 minute newscasts. And I was very friendly with her. And so I asked her to show me how to do the job. And so she did. And so I would sit there and pretend I was doing her job for the rest of the night. You know, I got off at 8 p.m. I would stay until midnight every night and just write these 1 minute newscasts as if I was the producer. And luckily I had a good boss at the time who allowed me to leave my scripts for him, and he would critique my writing and send them back to me. And I continued to do that for a period of time until he said, you know, I know you want to write, but I really think you need to consider broadcast. You have a great voice for it. You've already had some experience in it, and I think you'd be great at it. So he was the one who kind of steered me in that direction and started telling me, instead of sending me your scripts, I want you to go into the booth and I want you to record them. And I want you to send me the sound. And so that's what I started doing. And so he went from critiquing my writing to critiquing my delivery. And he was the first person who put me on air doing an American Idol podcast for Fox News Radio. Before I even really knew what podcasts were, I had one. Again, I didn't really know what I was doing at all. But that's kind of where my real start in broadcast began.
People have really taken a shine to this Knicks team. I'm one of them. It's just so refreshing to have a team that shows so much commitment to detail and that shows so much defensive intensity, which is what made the city fall in love with them in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Thibodeau has really been embraced by this city. And Julius Randle, after a really rough first season in New York, he's getting an MVP chance at the Garden. So to be around this team throughout this season, I mean, I imagine obviously it's been fun for you, but what's been the best thing? You talked about rooting earlier for people based on how they are off the court. What's been the best thing, therefore, about this particular team and covering it this season?
It's the same thing. It goes back to the character, and it's just so easy to get behind this team because there are just so many high character people in this organization. And on that team, I have so much respect for Coach, and I've known him for a very long time, obviously. And then obviously a lot of those players I've also known for a long time too. And to see such an amazing group come together, and they're just all about the work, and there's always more work to do, and it's always about the next step and more preparation. it's just really easy to support such a hardworking group of guys. And when you take a look at a guy like Julius Randle, I just really respect his character and everything that he brings to the table. And you're right, last year is not a great year for him, and he owned it. And then he did the work to change it. If you haven't read his Players Tribune article, it was spectacular. And
I did. Made me love him even more.
Yeah, it just, you really kind of get into his personality a little bit. And I think it's awesome that he is such a great family man. His wife Kendra is amazing. His son Kaiden is amazing. And I just love that the leader of that team is such a good person.
That's the thing. I mean, the things that they've done make you feel that way, to where, to borrow an old line from Jane's Addiction, nothing's shocking. But then again, you know, to actually profile him as so in depth, I have to ask, you know, a little while after that interview, when he was executed by lethal injection, I imagine, obviously, having chatted with him, you felt something beyond, okay, well, that's the headline of the day. What did you feel when you heard that he'd been executed?
So we Rick came over to my house. I lived in Los Angeles, and my daughter was not there. She was with her dad. And we watched the execution. Yeah. Come on, honey, sit down. Let's have some Pop-Tarts and watch the execution. Not that it was filmed, but they were outside the jail. And obviously, it was a big story. You know, it's funny. I'll meet people now sometimes, and I, you know, the Gacy thing comes up, and some people are like, who? I'm like, wow. You know, that he probably was the most prolific serial killer in the United States. But in any case, well, what happened was interesting. I can't remember exactly the time that he was set to get the injection, but let's say it was 9 p.m. Pacific time, where then they expected him to be dead in like 15 minutes. But he didn't die. He didn't die for something like 2.5 more hours, which was just nuts. You're like, wow, this guy really is larger than, you know, he is this large, monstrous character. But what I wrote and what I still think now is like, sure, we killed him, but we didn't. He goes on. Here we are. We are
27 years later, right?
Talking about this. You and I may never have met had this story done. He continues to be part of the connective tissue and Americana. So, and why is that? Well, because we created him. Right. So we maintain our fascinations for certain reasons. Who knows? But yeah, he died, but he's not dead in a sense.
The legacy in its twisted, all its twisted forms.
CBS Mornings with the change. You know, you look at the success of CBS Sunday Morning, which is known for great storytelling. And the thinking now is that we want to continue that through all 7 days of the week. So we pride ourselves on, and I love the phrase, exquisite original reporting and exquisite storytelling. And I think when it comes to storytelling and reporting, I think we are one of the best in the business. And we just continue that. I never want people to think, well, CBS Mornings is harder news edge, which we are, but I don't want people to think we don't have fun here, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't want people to think, oh, you know, it's the facts and nothing but the facts, because we have Nate Burleson, we have Tony DeCopel. You have me, and the three of us bring a different sense of humor to what we're covering, to being at the table. So I want people to think you can come and you can have fun and not be a comedy show. Nobody here is trying to be a comedy show, and we can do that.
It was probably about 4 months, 6 months, I think. I'm trying to remember. Maybe only a couple months. It was somewhere between January and probably June of, you know, following 9/11 that I interviewed Arafat. And it was in the midst of this, you know, conflagration yet again in the Middle East, where it's a cyclical thing. It happens all the time. But Arafat was a central figure for decades, as the leader of the Palestinian people. And there was some sense that he was losing control of them. He couldn't dictate to them how to behave if he was making deals with Americans. And that was what my interview with him was about. And he was under siege. His compound was being bombed, rubble all over the place. And I had to like clamber up over rubble to get in there. And they lost their power and their medical, you know, shipments. And Arafat was on needed medicine and water. And so that was a great interview because he was a huge figure. I mean, Arafat was a huge figure. You say the name Arafat and it was like, wow, you got Arafat? Whoa, you know, that's nuts. And so that was a great interview because he fed me a ton of gibberish in Arabic, right? And then, you know, the translator would give me his, and I know he can speak perfect English. And then he switched into English when he started getting mad. And I started getting the sound really needed. And he's like, I am Chairman Arafat. Don't tell me I don't have control of my people. I am the chairman, you know? So that was a great moment for me to be able to like, not get under his skin, but get him to the point where I was questioning whether he really was the guy he used to be, you know? And so getting that was really
awesome. Okay, this is happening. Go out and cover it and figure out what's going on and get back to us and we'll air it at 5 o'clock. And I'm sure there was some of that in News 12 too, but in the instances where you would have to go out there and find something, mm-hmm. what exactly would you look for and how would you find it?
And I mean, I still at CBS have to pitch stories every day. So that is definitely something I'm still doing is trying to find stories. It wasn't so much an instance of like you walk in for the day and they say, okay, we don't have an assignment of you. So go out and find what's going on. It was less about that. It was more about like, you know, you wanted to come in with story ideas that you could start working on for that day, whether it was, maybe it wasn't turnable for that night. And this is still the case. This applies to both jobs. You know, maybe it's not turnable for that night, but you can start making calls and start, you know, knocking on doors and finding out things that are going on to maybe finish it up another day or finish working another day. But yeah, for both these jobs, it's a lot of like trying to see what people in that area, whether it's the Bronx you're covering or whether it's all of New York City, what people are concerned about, what people are talking about, and what people want to bring attention to. And it's, you know, it's fine. It's talking to people that you met the day before and while you're interviewing them about topic A, getting into conversation about them. And a lot of times they want to share what other thing is going on. Like, I mean, a lot of times you go out and you start on a story and people say, you know, you really should be reporting on is XYZ. And maybe you don't do it that day, but you can look into it for another day. Or it's, you know, looking at things that are in the papers and things that are in the newspapers and trying to figure out how you can make it work for TV or who you know who can do interviews or who you can find who can do interviews and make it you know, a story.
You alluded to was humanizing, right? So there are 36,000 police officers in the city and not a lot of people know them, and we really wanted to show that personal side, and that was never really done before. So we wanted to show, like you said, you know, that they like sports, they have hobbies, they come from different countries, they speak different languages, and make demystify them a little bit and make them more accessible, more approachable to people through social media. Because unfortunately, and we see it a lot today, people still see police officers as them, right? Us versus them. And I really wanted to break that them a little bit and see that, you know, these are men and women in your community and just very, very different backgrounds and hopes and dreams, just like everybody
else. Now, this is the mecca of all things. It's the crossroads of the world, sports, news, certainly. And when that offer comes, when that opportunity arises, however it may arise, you talked earlier about taking deep breaths. You probably take the deepest breath of all when you're looking at the opportunity to work in the Big Apple. But you were comfortable in Nashville. You liked Nashville. Nashville is no small market in its own right. It's a very big city, as you well know. How did that opportunity come about? And what went through your mind as you were weighing this offer and ultimately wound up accepting it?
Remember that guy I told you that I really loved and follow him all around? It was because of him again.
Oh, of course. Yes.
He got called up and selected to teach up at West Point. He's an 05 West Point grad, and he went back to be a TAC officer and had an opportunity to go to Columbia for grad school. And I said, okay, I'm kind of young. I don't have a ton of experience. Like, what are you doing to me? Like, how am I going to get a job in New York City? And funny enough, a software platform that a company that we used in Nashville was trying to get into the New York market, and they had used some of my reports as an example. So I get a call from a news director at WCBS who's like, hi, so we're not going to buy the software that this company sent, but I asked who you were and I tracked down your information. I thought it was a joke. I was like, yeah, right. Yeah, you just saw me and called me. He didn't interview me. He said, if you can be here in 2 weeks, you've got a job. And I said, okay, I will be there in 2 weeks. And Ty wasn't moving up there yet, but I moved to Jersey City. I have some family there. So I lived right in Bowers. And I said, all right, like I'll do this. And for 6 months, I was up there alone and it was awesome. And I was just so excited. I don't really live in fear, and maybe sometimes I should, but I just think this is what an opportunity. People dream of this. Like I have to be wonderful. I have to be
point blank. At a killer's core. Well, just that. What is at a killer's core? It has to be more than depravity.
So yeah, there are numerous factors that go into the making of a killer. For example, I was at the BTK sentencing. I'll talk about that in particular. Mm-hmm. I tell you, when I left that courthouse, I covered that for Fox, and I really was crying like a child at the airport. Why? Because he stood there, proud as could be, referring to himself in the third person and taking complete responsibility for these projects that he called his victims that he murdered and bound and tortured and then had twisted sex with corpses. I mean, somebody like that is made, first of all, they start out being deviants, all right? There's something obviously wrong with the way they perceive the world. But yet, many of these people are able to have that double life. They can compartmentalize. And so the one side, you know, he's working as a dog catcher, he has a job with the city, he's involved with his church, he's a deacon in the church, whatever case. I mean, he's got that family life and all of that. On the other side, he's prowling the streets of Wichita for 30 years. And when you talk about a boogeyman, he was the boogeyman. Okay. And somehow he takes solace in this. He thinks this is great because once he satisfied the urge of killing what he was going to kill, just one woman, now the urge becomes stronger and stronger. And what I find is killers can't help themselves. And this is why, if you look, for example, Durst, he got away with the thing in Texas. He got away with killing his wife, Kathleen. Now he went to his best friend, Susan Berman. It escalates for them. It becomes a game. It becomes a twisted game. And I don't know if partially it's because they can't get that out of their mind. I think so. This is what I think. When you kill somebody, it's not easy. I don't care how depraved you are. But once you've done it, now that runs in your mind. That tape is running in your mind all the time. You're living with some consciousness of guilt. Even if you're a psychopath, even if you're a serial killer, you are still playing that tape over and over in your mind. You can't just forget it. Okay? So it kind of snowballs on itself for these people who become serial killers or killing more than one person. And it may not be there'll be a number of years between where nothing happened, like Durst, like BTK, like this guy, Carl Carlson. There's a number of years, nothing happened. But somehow or another, they get back to that depraved moment because, again, they got away with it once, and then it's twice, and then it's another time. So, you know, it's circumstances as well as the depraved mind. And obviously, there's something in the brain of killers, of murderers, of people who are willing to take another's life that is missing, isn't right. And there's been study about it, the anatomy of a murderer. You know, I'm aware of those kinds of studies. And again, what they say is, yes, there's something in the brain that's not quite the same if you do a scan of the brain than normal people. But because we don't understand the brain, because we only use allegedly 5 or 6% of our brain, we don't really have a grasp or a full sense of what it is piece they're missing. How it is that they really have no sense of, forget about empathy, they have no sense of responsibility, they have no sense of humanity, they have no sense of the worth of human life. I mean, how that happens is as much a symptom of what their circumstances are and what they've gotten away with as it is how their brain works and functions, malfunctions. And I don't know that we'll ever quite get in there.
The Jersey City shootout. It's one thing to get there after something has happened, but you were there during, and you could hear the gunfire in the background. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here are the police shooting it out with these two heavily armed individuals.
and you know that the Detective Seals has been shot. He hadn't died yet. He was gravely injured in the hospital, and more people were hurt and ultimately killed in the store where the shootout took place. Being there as it's happening, I don't know how else to ask the question. How the heck did you stay so calm?
You know, I remember that so vividly. First of all, our first responders are tremendous. You know, we were at a safe distance. Well, I mean, when we got there, we didn't know what was going on, but we were obviously at a safe distance. They were all running towards it. So I got to say, first and foremost, I mean, incredible to run towards that and to be, you know, trying to help and save people. We got there. We had actually been in Central Jersey doing a fun, light story at a diner, got the call. We hightailed it out of there and drove to Jersey City. Literally the only line of information we had going into this was an officer may have been shot. That's it. We didn't know anything else. So we pulled up to the area and we got out of the car and immediately heard gunfire, not just one or two shots, rapid gunfire. And I was with two photographers that day, which is unusual because during the day, usually we're just paired with one. And one of them looked at me and was like, we got to get out of here. And the other photographer and I looked at each other and we're like, we were trying to assess, well, we didn't even know what was going on, right? So I looked and I saw an officer kind of blocking the street and I thought, well, and there were people standing outside kind of, you know, people who lived in the neighborhood watching. So I'm like, well, if they're out here, maybe we're probably fine. So I said, you can go if you want. You know, our station tells us if you feel unsafe, leave, no questions asked. But we all three of us stayed and we heard again, more gunfire. And the thing was, it was echoing. So we didn't even know where it was coming from. Sounded like it was coming from here. Sounded like it was coming from here. We saw drones above us. I saw a chopper, and I had been in Jersey City once before during a manhunt. So I knew they were looking for somebody. So I'm like, I don't know. Is there somebody on the building? You know, we didn't know, but you just feel like you're there. You have a job to do. You know, we didn't know if we were in danger, but I didn't in that moment feel like we were necessarily in immediate danger. So we stayed. But I will say there are only two times in my career I've ever texted my family just in case. One, I was flying in a B-17 bomber.
I remember that story.
I was like, I don't know if I should be going in this plane. So I texted, you know, I think my parents real quick, like, hey, just in case, love you guys. And then, you know, in this moment, I texted my family and I said, hey, I just want you to know where I am. I'm okay. But, you know, I just want to let you know this is where I am. And of course, everyone's like, leave, don't stay there. Yeah. So, I mean, thankfully where we were okay. But, you know, those initial moments, we, like I said, we had that one piece of information. We're hearing gunshots. We don't know where they're coming from. And we're seeing this commotion, this search above us. So, you know, that I'm not a war correspondent, not reported overseas. So that was my first experience walking into the most active scene I've ever, you know, experienced.
Fixing some things in this room where all these snakes were. And he fell on the drill and it drilled in his head. So his brother came home and backed the drill out and called the police. So Ron went in to see, you know, what else they needed. And there's all these tanks. So Ron comes out and he's like shaking his head. If you know Ron, I'm like, What's the problem? He said, they got a few snakes here. And I'm like, what's a few? And we went in and there were literally, I didn't know it at the time, but there were literally anacondas, you know, all kind of venomous snakes. And they were of various sizes. And this gentleman had built a whole like wall where he had these huge cases that, you know, to hold them, to keep them in their cages, I guess. But they were huge. So the animals had a lot of freedom. So I go up and I said, you know, we can't just take these snakes out. And trust me, I'm scared to death. I'm not ashamed to tell you that. I'm scared to death because these are huge, huge snakes. And I know there's no one working but us. So we called for another truck. Truck 7 came over to help us. So I went up to the truck. I was the chauffeur. And I called Rodney on the phone. I said, Rod, listen, we have a bunch of snakes. I said, these are really big snakes. And, you know, we're going to need, once we get them, or whoever you call, we need someone to come and, you know, house these snakes. And he said to me, Manny, stop with the big snakes. You know, these aren't big snakes, you know. And he laughed at me. So I said, you know, because we've known each other so long, I said, you know what? All right. That's okay. I said, I'll wait till you get here. So he comes right over and he goes in the back where the dead guy is, and the snakes are all around. And he's not saying anything. He's just like shaking his head and looking around. So I said to him, oh, are these little snakes? What do you think? Which one are you going to get out first? You know, so that was always like a little bit of a joke between I and Ron. There was a 8-4 guy there and then two other people, and there were 13 snakes, huge snakes. The biggest one was 19 and a half feet, and the girth, I mean, we held him, and he was literally, the muscle in his snake was just pushing us back and forth, until we could get them. And we were fortunate enough to get someone from the Center for Animal Care and Control. And this one's on the midnight. And he was able, Wes was able to come over and help us and guide us. But we worked the rest of that night until dawn.
Everybody was like, so what do you think? And I was sort of like, come on, you know, like I was enjoying my sort of hangout, like figure my life out kind of time. And I came home and I told my husband, I said, oh, you know, these guys all called me and they really want me to take this job. And I was like, you know what? I don't know. And then I kind of paused. And I was like, what, am I an idiot? Like, of course I'm going to take this job. I mean, it was like a no brainer. You know, I had sort of joked when I went to grad school I went to get my master's in public administration. And even when I was in grad school, I said to people who asked me, why are you in grad school? And I was like, well, I don't really want to be like 50 something standing on a street corner telling people that it's snowing. Like, that just seems like something that I would outgrow. Do I love reporting? Of course. But like, just, you know, what the trajectory was. And I was like, I know if I want to, you know, I'm always interested in city government. I love the fire department. I don't know. If I want to do anything of any, you know, substance, I'll have to have a managerial master's anyway. So I was like, I'll probably just, and I said it like a million times. I was like, I'll probably just go work for the fire department, whatever. And I just kind of blew it off. And then there was like on a platter, and I was like, and so it was sort of serendipitous, but also just kind of amazing that it worked out the way that it did, because it is in many ways a very natural extension for the kind of stuff I was doing before, because I was so connected. There was really very little transition for me, because I already speak the language. I already know, I have enough institutional knowledge from my coverage from New York One. And also just like, you know, my brother is still active. I have many friends who are still active. Several of my girlfriends are married to firefighters. I hate to say like, it's just been easy, but it's just been easy. And I feel like that's a blessing, because I enjoy it and it's fun, and it really doesn't feel like work. And I wasn't fully confident that would happen again, because I'd always had that kind of career at New York One where it didn't feel like work. It just was like kind of fun. And this is kind of an extension of that, and I feel really grateful for that. So it's been a good fit.
Going out to lunch, my boss took me out to lunch, Jackie Mulk Moscow, and she was like, what do you want to do? And it was the first time I actually said it, where I was like, I think I want to pursue this thing in TV. And anybody else who I had ever said that to, were like, do you see how few people make it on TV? Do you see this? It's like never going to happen. And she was the first person. And I like need to reconnect with her to tell her this, to be like, I could see that. That would be so great. You should do that. And there was a, we got some sort of like a outplacement service because we had all been laid off. So I met with this woman and I told her that. And she was like, okay, there's like a couple of different programs. So I found a course at NYU. And then I found this digital journalism program at the New York Film Academy, which at the time, NBC, like our teacher was from NBC. So I was like, all right, let me just try it. I'll try it for 4 weeks. I spent like more money on that in 4 weeks than I spent like on my college education. And I was hooked. And so I extended it to 8 weeks, to one semester, and then to the whole year. So then I graduated with a degree, or I guess a certificate, I should say, in digital journalism. But this is like before people were like, we didn't have iPhones really. Like, I think like the iPhone just came out, but like, yep, very few people had it. So I was forced into taking a risk. I need to be forced into risky situations. Like, I think that's the accountant in me. I don't like it, you know?
We'll say discipline nearly to a fault.
Yeah,
that's there a good you go. Way to, that's there a good go. Way of describing there it. So,
part of the problem with the news business today is that boring doesn't make any money. There's no profit in boring. And so they do everything they can to gin up the ratings. And they do that by, you know, sensationalizing the stories and the coverage. And that's unfortunate. I think that's kind of the downfall of the news business today. But that's a whole other tangent we can get into on another day.
Let me ask you, the national aspect of news, different story, but locally, especially in New York, where you've spent so much of your career, do you like the direction it's heading in locally, at least?
No, not really.
Why is that?
Opinion journalism is taking over. And, you know, what is it about the news that makes the news so valuable? Facts. And, you know, that day that Kellyanne Conway said that there are alternate facts was, I think, a very dark day for all of us in the news business, because as soon as you start talking about alternate facts, which is just opinion, you lose the trust of your audience. And if you lose the trust of your audience, then there's no point in going on TV. I mean, you have to speak the truth, and people have to respect you for that. And if they don't, you know, everybody has an echo chamber that they are listening to now. And so I think we're responsible for our own demise at this point. All this, you know, opinion journalism. You know, if you want to hear opinions in the news, then turn to Trevor Noah or Steve Colbert, because at least they're entertaining. But everybody has an opinion. You remember Daniel Patrick Moynihan that, you know, had that great, great line, you're entitled to your own opinion. You are not entitled to your own facts. And at this point, everybody's entitled to their own facts. And if your facts don't match my facts, then I'll turn the channel and watch somebody who will validate the facts that I feel, you know, and then there's no point in having a news operation.